Thank you. And that will give us a nice little bit of time for discussion, and I imagine there are some questions. Mm-hmm. Who may I give the floor first?
Do you have a question?
No.
I mean, you.
Yeah, of course, it always falls down to me. one very practical question. How can our teachers and our staff push back on the government curriculum when they are faced with the inspection every other year?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's a school principal sitting at the back of the auditorium.
That's why I asked, because I want to help him next year. Yeah. It's his first time.
Yeah. So I think, okay, from a practical legal perspective, it seems to me that you have a stronger legal case the closer your curriculum and your policies align with your faith. And the reason I say that is because where there's been compromise in a policy, where there's been compromise in curriculum, where we've accepted as true things that aren't true, we've accepted certain tenets of the secular humanist faith, and we've incorporated that somewhere, then those are cracks in the foundation that a human rights tribunal, for example, or a ministry official at the Ministry of Education is going to see that, look at that, and say, look, like, you've compromised here. They don't see it as compromise, but you've moved towards our position here, here, and here. Why not also move on this issue or that issue? And I think that if I was a lawyer defending a Christian school that was holding the line on curriculum or holding the line on a policy, let's say a bullying policy, and where that policy has been informed by Scripture and shaped by Scripture, I think you have a stronger case in front of a judge. We say, look, this is who we are. This is what we believe to be true. These are doctrinal truths for us that we hold. And as long as it's not harming another person, you got to accommodate that. You, the state, have got to accommodate that. Ontario is a little different than Alberta, BC, and Manitoba. In Alberta, Manitoba, and BC, the law, when it affects schools, it affects all of the schools the same. The independent Christian schools and the public schools are ruled by or governed by the same law. And so there, it's a bit, they've got more freedom in certain respects, and they certainly have more funding. We don't have any. But it's different there than it is in Ontario. In Ontario, the elementary schools are actually not even governed by the Ministry of Education. The Ministry of Education considers a private elementary Christian school to be basically like a small business, and they more or less leave it alone. It's the high schools, of course, if you want to be able to offer the OSSD, the Ontario Secondary School Diploma, that's what gets inspected, and so on. I've also heard, I'm not a school administrator, but I've also heard that it varies, right, depending on who your inspector is. Is your inspector a friendly person who recognizes the value of what you're doing? Then they'll usually give you more latitude. They understand who you are. They understand what your project is, what you're doing. Other inspectors can be mean-spirited, very narrow-minded people. So it's somewhat fact-specific. But I'd say hold the line, be true to who you are, and be clear about that. The clearer you are, the easier it is to defend, I think, in court.
Okay. Oh, I've done it. Now it's your turn. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, you can, but this is better.
I appreciate that you brought up the book, The Benedict Option. Mm-hmm. It seems like that book points more towards going towards the fortification approach to Christian education. I was just wondering, how close are we to getting to requiring a Benedict option or the fortification approach?
Yeah, so you've read the book, Aaron? Yeah, so when I read the book, so there's the Benedict option. Yeah, I've actually, I brought it with me, but I think I left it in the car. So anyway, the Benedict option is written by a Greek Orthodox person who used to be Catholic, and he's writing about the Benedictine monasteries and that tradition from the Roman Catholic tradition. And he's saying that as Christians in North America and Europe, we need to be taking notes from the way they do Benedictine monasteries. We, you know, live in community, you know, separate yourself from the world a little bit, And he applies that to various issues. So there's a chapter on education where he highly recommends, well, he says, like, pull your kids out of public school, first of all, set up independent classical Christian schools or homeschool. That's what he recommends. He writes a piece on sexuality and marriage and a chapter on technology use. And it's a good book. I recommend it. But the interesting thing about reading the Benedict Option for me, and I think it's been misread by a lot of people, but when I read it, I thought of, sounds to me like he's describing the Dutch Reformed Church, because a lot of what he was talking about we're already doing, and so it's really neat to see a guy who's been a cultural commentator for years and years and years. He's a journalist, a really he's a great writer, well respected in the States. Came out of the Catholic tradition. He actually left the Catholic Church because of the sex abuse scandals years and years ago. Joined the Greek Orthodox Church. And he's kind of discovered this Benedict option, which we've been living for the last 100 years or so, Kuyperian sphere sovereignty type community. And so, yeah, I recommend the book because it kind of affirms what we're doing, and yet at the same time warns about the dangers of where we're starting to get a little bit soft on the edges. So highly recommend it. I didn't really answer your question, though, because you asked about, do we need to become more isolationist? Yeah. And I think no. I think we just keep doing what we're doing. So so that Christian school back there, keep doing it. Encourage other people in your church to, unless they're homeschooling, which I endorse as a biblical way of doing school. But if they're not homeschooling, you know, encourage Christians to send their kids to a Christian school, to do that in community with one another, to uphold it. Don't let people get lazy about, you know, handing their kids over to Caesar to educate them, that kind of stuff. I think that trend is starting to increase. If there's a parent here who does send their kids to public education, I'm willing to banter and debate about that. But yeah, like I said, if they're teaching my 4-year-old son about family being two guys getting married, they're teaching more to your kid in grade 7 or 8 or 12.
Okay. Who's there?
I didn't say enough controversial stuff, I suppose. I should have said more controversial stuff, I guess.
Yeah, well, go ahead.
No. Well, maybe somebody can ask me a controversial question, and then I'll say controversial stuff.
Okay. There's one.
I should see if my...
So under point 5, in part D, in incarnation, it's under the heading of Christian education, but when you were speaking of it, it seemed to be you were speaking more of a church than a school. So can you maybe expand on that a bit?
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for that. So the first three, fortification, accommodation, and domination, were created by, I think, the journalist Amy, I forget her last name now, but and she was applying it to the church generally. And when I read that, I'm like, that sounds like the same kind of attitude. It can also inform the way we set up a school. And so I applied it to the school. So the same thing then with incarnation. So a different writer took what Amy had developed with those three, and he came up with his incarnation model. And he was applying it certainly to the church generally. And I think first it's about the church generally. But it also, I think, applies to our schools. So I want to encourage us as Christians who might be supporting a Christian school, say Guido or Heritage or John Calvin back here, that we not set it up as being just a project for the purposes of just raising the kids inside the school to stay inside the Christian community so they just stay Canadian Reformed or Reformed or what have you. The purpose of the school is bigger vision than that. So the purpose of the school is not just to teach the kids the mathematics, ABCs, and all that kind of stuff. And it's not just to teach them Christian values, besides that Christian values need to be taught in the home first anyway. But it's also to equip them to, like the barracks, right? Equip them, train them, so that once they graduate, they are fully ready and equipped and to go out and be that salt and light for the culture, to be a blessing to the nation. I love the passage in Jeremiah 29 because it's It's that kind of thing that I think the incarnation model is talking about. So if I pull up Jeremiah 29, I could probably look it up quicker with a hard copy than my app here. But if you go to Jeremiah 29, it's a love letter from the Lord to his people in captivity. And so it starts at verse 4. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon, build houses, live in them, plant gardens, and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and do not decrease, but seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, that is Babylon, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will find your welfare. Be a blessing in the land of exile. That's pretty radical, what God is asking the people to do. And I think as the culture's shifting quite a bit away from the Christian worldview, away from Judeo-Christian heritage, we're becoming more and more Babylon-like. We're becoming more and more a church in exile. And yet our attitude is not of isolationist self-preservation so much, but it's still that attitude. We're in hostile country, and yet we want to benefit the welfare of the country and the city that we're around. And that's what our schools need to be doing for our kids. Not just teaching them how to count and how to read and how to get a good job and good paying salary and so on. And we're not just teaching them, you know, doctrines for their own sake so that they are right with God in their own little silo. We want to equip them to be culture makers and changers in the arts and in politics and in science and medicine and journalism and everywhere else. Does that answer your question?
You've encouraged us to take our kids out of the public system and have them educated in a Christian school. Mm. Could you comment on taking what you think about taking that one step further and inviting the public kids into our school?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Now you got a controversial one.
Yeah. Okay. So I'd say you can't dabble in either model. So I'd say you can either have a school that's a school meant to be a covenant school where the community is, parents by delegating, and then the community itself by supporting is raising kids of the church community to be these ambassadors for Jesus Christ to go out. Great model, fully endorse it. That's, I think, what John Calvin here is doing, what Guido is doing. I think also a good model that you could do is a missional model, where say we're going to create a Christian school with Christian teachers funded by the church, and the purpose of this Christian school is to educate children of unchurched people with our own churched kids with the intentionality of trying to bring the gospel to these kids in this Christian environment. And in order to send your kids here, you as parents, as unchurched parents, would have to be fully aware of what we're doing with this project, sign on to it, endorse it, consent to it, and so on, and then away we go. There are two different models. I think both are good, but you can't mix. I don't think you can do a little bit of both. It's because I think the approach to the education is going to be different, and the parents in the one are going to be expecting something different than the parents in the other. So it would have to be, there'd be different mindsets and approaches to how you're doing it. Now that said, there's a greater legal challenge to the model that you just raised. And this is what I think really exemplifies the problem with our tolerance approach in law right now, because the people that lose out are the people who need the help. So imagine we were to say, okay, let's go downtown core of Hamilton, let's say, a really underprivileged area, and we want to set up a Christian school for people who lack, they can't read, they can't do basic arithmetic because the public schools kind of, you know, are just junk in that area, let's say. This is worse in the States, particularly in certain urban settings. You get quite a difference in public education there. It's not as bad here in Canada. But let's say we want to do that. The change in law is that if you serve people not from your own religious community, then human rights law treats you differently than if you only exclusively serve your own people. So if you serve exclusively your own people, you'll get greater legal protection than if you, out of your religious convictions, want to serve others. And it completely undermines the purpose of the gospel, which is to serve other people, right? you know, we live in Christian community and benefit from that, but that, you know, when the commission, the Great Commission, Matthew 28, is about also then serving other people outside, and through your service you win them for Christ. And our law has undercut that completely, and it's really frustrating to me as a lawyer. But I like the model. Yeah.
Okay.
Andre, you've been very logical up until this point, but I think you contradicted your barracks analogy.
Mm-hmm.
In basically when you're encouraging the mixed schooling between the churched and the unchurched.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not certain.
Right. So that's why I think you can't mix it. You can't mix it. So there are two. So John Calvin, Guido, Heritage, they're set up as a barracks. And that's why I would imagine them as a barracks, because they're a covenant school for covenant children to raise them and equip them to go out into the world. Good model. Different model, not a barracks model, would be, okay, we as a community are going to do this community project where it's not to raise the kids to be, I mean, you would still teach them from a Christian perspective and so on, but the primary mission of this church is not to raise covenant children to be cultural engagers and so on. That's the mission of a barracks church. The mission of this kind of church is to be missional to underprivileged families, let's say, or to bring the gospel through education to children outside of the church. It's a different mission and a different model completely. So you're right. Like, they're two different models, and they would otherwise be contradictory. But if you can have one or the other, but you can't try to mix both. You can't say, "Oh, we're going to raise covenant children to be, you know, cultural engagers and so on, and equip them and everything else within this model," and at the same time, we're going to try to be missional and so on, because there are going to be two different ways that you're educating. Yeah.
So are you separating the two then? I just want, as a follow-up then, is the one school going to be completely unchurched kids and the other school is going to be church kids only? Because if that's not the case, you're still not making sense to me.
Yeah. So I would say you can put churched kids in the missional school, but then you're going to have to be very intentional about how you equip those kids, and you're going to have a ton of buy-in at home. So with the other model, I would see it as being not nearly as much just parents of a. So let's use this church, okay? Smithville Canadian Reformed Church. Let's assume that Smithville, the John Calvin Christian School behind it. So in this model, you know, the parents are sending their own kids to that school. It's within a closed community. Everyone's on the same page about basic understandings of Scripture, of doctrine. You worship together on Sunday. Everything else. Let's say Smithville Canadian Reformed Church says, okay, we're also going to start a missional school. Then it's going to become a complete. It's going to be a community project where the members of this church are going to say, okay, we're going to make sure we're volunteering to help support this school. We're going to make sure there's extra programs in it. We're going to be reaching out to the parents of these unchurched people to bring them to bring the gospel to them. It's just going to be a completely different. I think it's going to be a different model. So it's not that your own Christian kids couldn't go there. They could be, but you're going to be on guard in a different way. You're going to be teaching a different way. You're going to be making sure you have extra classes. Perhaps in the evening your church would do extra classes, so you do catechism classes, let's say on Tuesday or Wednesday, and then you're going to do cultural apologetics or whatever. I would imagine that you'd start seeing, you know, those extra kind of church classes for the covenant youth being this extra add-on to make sure that they're still getting that kind of instruction. But I don't know. I haven't thought deeply about this, so maybe I remain illogical, but I think they're two different models that either could work, but if you try to mix the models and you get then you get the contradiction.
Right. And I'm just thinking that, the image of God, I think we can still disagree with each other, right?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
And I still do. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else?
We're at 9:25. So if we want to, like, pray, which is a good thing to do, and I'm assuming you do anyway, and still honor your 9:30 time, I can hang around afterwards to answer questions.
Okay.
And then you can still...
Wait a minute, we've got time for one more.
One more, okay.
You had spoken a bit about sexual orientation being intrinsically tied to people's personal identity, especially as a concept introduced more recently. I was wondering if you could expand upon that and its impact, especially moving forward in the 21st century.
Yeah, okay. So where you really see it in law, anyway, is in the Trinity Western University case in 2001, so 18 years ago, 17 years ago, the Supreme Court of Canada had written a decision in favor of Trinity Western back then, saying they're allowed to have their school and so on. And there's, so eight of the judges agreed with Trinity Western, one judge did not. That one judge, her name was Justice Lourdes Dubé, she wrote a dissenting opinion in which she said, I find it, I'm paraphrasing here, but, you know, abhorrent that this Christian community says you can hate the sin and love the sinner. And she goes on about how the sin in this case, homosexual activity, is so intrinsic to the identity of the sinner that to hate the sin is to hate the sinner. And she makes that point all on her lonesome self, one judge, 2001, buried in the annals of history. Well, in 2012, the Supreme Court of Canada released a decision on hate speech in the Walcott decision, and there it was a six-judge decision, and all six judges adopted Justice Lourdes Dubé's reasoning in the Trinity Western case, and they said to draw a distinction between sin and sinner in instances where the sin is intrinsically linked to the identity of the sinner, they said is a distinction without a difference. And so, you know, that's not a defense. They said it's not a defense to say, well, I'm just being critical of the sin and not of the sinner. Therefore, you know, I'm not being hateful towards the sinner. And the Supreme Court of Canada basically said, well, that's not good enough. You've got to do better than that. Now, that particular case was a bad set of facts for us as Christians because Mr. Watcott, frankly, does not know how to share the gospel winsomely or lovingly. Maybe that's a disagreement that Christians can have, but his way of sharing the gospel was abysmal, and it's no wonder, I think, that Supreme Court judges who aren't Christians saw what he was doing and said, well, you know, his critique of the sin is just as much hate-filled vitriol towards the sinner. I can understand how they got there. Sadly, though, that kind of thinking now has been also endorsed in the latest Supreme Court of Canada decision on Trinity Western, where they've said the same thing. Said, you as a Christian community, if you draw a distinction between sin and sinner, and the sin is intrinsically attached to the identity of the sinner, in this case, homosexual activity, and, you know, identifying as gay or identifying as lesbian or identifying as bisexual, I suppose, they said that kind of a difference is a distinction without a difference. They said you can't do that. We won't tolerate that. But the reality is we do that all the time as human beings. I mean, if I say, you know, we do it with alcoholism, for example. We, you know, somebody who drinks to excess and has an addiction for that, we can draw a distinction between the sin of excessive drinking and the person who's struggling with the addiction to alcohol. We do it with... we do it with all kinds of different issues, right? So that's where, in this situation, when it comes to sexual identity, we've changed that game, we've changed that that understanding quite a bit. And I think you can trace that back to Sigmund Freud's philosophy and psychology of sexual orientation.
Okay, we're going to leave it there because we've got 5 minutes to close. Closing with us will be the principal of John Calvin School, Mr. Come on. George?
Mr. George.
And after that, there will be coffee, and you can still chat with Andrea after if you like. Thank you very much.